Hey, this is Scott Ardella, author of The Edge of Strength, now available on Amazon, and you're listening to the Ardella Training Podcast, the strength and performance podcast for the serious fitness enthusiast. Now, let's get started with this week's show. Hey guys, if you want to learn all about my unconventional but powerful approach to maximizing strength and physical potential, you'll find everything in my book, The Edge of Strength. This book contains the key insights I've discovered through decades of training experiences, drilled down to what matters most. Nearly 300 pages, 27 chapters, and practical, actionable, and valuable information and resources, no matter where you are in your training journey, beginner or advanced, you'll gain new insights to achieve long-term results. And that is what it's all about. You can get the book right now at Amazon.com as a print or Kindle edition, although I recommend the print book because I want you to be able to refer back to this and apply the information. If you want to check out a sample chapter, you can go to ardellatraining.com/edgebook to learn more and download a free chapter right now. Once again, go to ardellatraining.com/edgebook. The Edge of Strength is an unconventional guide to live your strength and discover your greatness. Check it out. What's up, guys? Welcome to episode number 170 this week with my guest, the one and only Dr. Kelly Starrett. This is Kelly's fourth appearance on the podcast, and this is another incredible interview session that I absolutely know that you will love. You'll get actionable, practical tips and strategies to improve performance and biomechanics and free yourself from being desk-bound and prevent all the issues and hazards that come with prolonged sitting. Desk-bound is the title of Kelly's brand new book, titled Deskbound, Standing Up to a Sitting World, in which he co-wrote with his amazing wife, Juliet Starrett, and also Glenn Cordoza. I was extremely privileged to get an advanced copy of this book, and it really has been mind-blowing so far, and I highly recommend this incredible book. As a matter of fact, I can't think of anyone who wouldn't benefit from this great book. Now, let me tell you how you can win a free copy of this book, but there is a very small window of opportunity for you to do this. So please listen carefully to the details now. And I'll also mention this at the end of the interview session so you can hear it again later. I'm giving away 10 free copies of Deskbound. I wanted to get this great book out there and get it into your hands. I also wanted to make a contribution, as I have in the past, to standupkids.org. 100% of the pre-sale orders go to this organization. So my commitment is purchasing 10 books during the pre-sale time period, which will go to standupkids.org. Basically, my contribution will provide a new stand-up desk for a particular school. To learn more about this, definitely go to standupkids.org. Again, I'm giving away 10 books of the new book, Deskbound. Now, here's all you have to do, and you must live in the continental United States. Again, I want to repeat this once again. You must live in the continental United States. All you need to do is drop in your review in iTunes for the Ardella Training Podcast, hopefully a 5-star review. This giveaway is only for new reviews. Again, only for new reviews. Send me your screenshot of the new review to scott@ardellatraining.com. The deadline to send me your review is the end of the day, Sunday, April the 24th. So you have to act fast and get this to me again by Sunday, April the 24th. Email me or contact me through my website, ardellatraining.com. And that's it. This is your opportunity to get a free copy of Deskbound. And those books will go right out. You should get it right around the launch date, which is April the 26th. All right, let's get into the interview this week. And let me tell you very briefly about Kelly, as I am quite sure that everybody listening here is already very familiar with Kelly Starrett, the creator of MobilityWad.com and the New York Times best-selling author of Becoming a Supple Leopard. Kelly is a revolutionary physical therapist, strength coach, and co-owner of San Francisco CrossFit, where his innovative approach to movement, biomechanics, and mobility have changed human performance. Kelly travels the world teaching his movement and mobility approach, and I've been fortunate to meet Kelly personally down here in South Florida, and he's a great person. He works with elite athletes and universities and is an international speaker, and his work has radically changed the way we deal with injury and human performance. His simple philosophy is that every human being should be able to perform basic maintenance on themselves. I'm totally excited to bring you this incredible interview prior to the upcoming release of the groundbreaking new book, Deskbound, which again comes out on April the 26th. Listen, learn, and consider what you might take away from this interview and apply in your life to optimize performance. All right, so let's jump into the interview this week with Kelly Starrett. Enjoy, guys. All right, Kelly, you are making the fourth appearance back on the show. I don't know if you realize that or not. That makes you and Dan John the only four-time guests on the Ardella Training Podcast. So welcome back, brother. I appreciate it.
That's amazing. I've seen this Saturday Night Live skit. And if any time you're in the same sentence as Dan John, you're either doing something terribly wrong or completely right.
Nice. Well, before we get into this, and I've got a ton of great questions for you, I'm dying to talk to you about all the great questions and topics around the new book, Deskbound, and the consequences of sitting and the benefits of moving more. But you and the audience should know that right now, this is the very first podcast I've ever done entirely while standing up. And Deskbound has made an impact on me already because I'm always sitting at my desk through all these interviews. And I actually changed my equipment today so that I could stand as I do this interview. So for the next 60 minutes or so, I'm standing up here, brother. So great job. And this book is going to be just tremendous in the impact it's going to have on people. And that leads me to the opening question. So you have three major books now, Supple Leopard, Ready to Run, and now Deskbound. So what do you think is the most important book out of these three for most people?
Well, you know, first and foremost, I'll say good job not violating the pact you have with your physiology by sitting, like not sitting. I mean, that's a huge deal. And so I'll answer that question saying, but let's pan back out. Let's go way out and say, what is this? What are we talking about? You know, in the world, especially in fitness right now, if I can quote my friend Carl Pally, he's like, it's such a crowded, crappy space, right? There's so much noise. There's so much, you know, this guru or this expert or this squat sequence or, you know, this stretching. And it's really difficult sometimes for a lay person. And I remember I'm a consumer too. My Twitter feed and Instagram feed is just full of, you know, what's happening in the world of my cohort. But sometimes it's hard to see the forest for the trees, and we become so micro obsessed that we've lost the big vision. And if we pan back out for a second, we can start to ask, what does it mean to be a human animal? You know, and that means it really simplifies the things. For example, one of the things that we're supposed to be doing is in constant motion. What's how we're designed? It's how the lymphatics move. And if you go back down into the micro, we're like, oh, hey, if you're immobilized during an injury or a problem or surgery, and you can't contract your musculature, you don't have a mechanism to drain the swelling out of your body. It just doesn't work very well, right? So we see really inflamed tissues, right? We see the errors around that. We pan back out and we're like, oh, if I don't move on an airplane, I get cankles. If I'm a casual runner and I go blast out for an hour at lunchtime, because that's the only time of day I can train, and I come back in and sit down at my desk, what's the error around my physiology? What's the adaptation error happening? You know, and what we can start to see then is, oh, hey, I am designed to be moving. If we go back in to the micro, it turns out research around kids who have diagnosis of ADD or ADHD, their brains literally don't work. They can't learn unless they're moving. We pan back out a little bit, and all of a sudden you can see that, you know, we've got to make sure that we're understanding that the human brain evolved with the movement brain, that these are integrated systems. So when we start asking or looking at the environment or looking at what's happening, it becomes very clear that, hey, a sedentary person is not really being a person. And so of all the books that we've done, and we think that the second edition of Supple Leopard is a totally different book. So, but this is the most important thing we've done, because we have always sort of maintained that what we're trying to do is take the highest concepts of sport performance and apply those principles backwards through the strata of humans, through the cohort out there. And that this is the one that we're most passionate about, because we see that it's going to have the biggest impact on young people, on diabetes, on ADHD, on test scores, on productivity, on orthopedic dysfunction. You can come at this from any angle that's important to you, and you know it can matter to you. And what we're really saying is, hey, not only should we be moving, but there's skill to standing, there's skill to walking, there's skill to being organized and hinging. And what we've really have tried to do is strip out all of the technical language and giving people a really simple blueprint so that they can get by from their day to day. Because in the fitness world, it's easy to be in this little bubble and then forget that most of us are trapped at our desks with busy families and craziness. And it's difficult to sort of reconcile the average everyday worker who's trying to do the right thing, trying to walk more, trying to exercise more with, you know, this kind of elite fitness thing that we're seeing happen on the side.
Right. So, you know, this is, again, a hugely valuable book. And one of the things that I was really interested in before receiving it, and again, I just got it a couple of days ago. So I had read other books on the topic, and I think people are becoming more aware of the dangers, the hazards of sitting, prolonged sitting. Ugh. So I was curious, you know, how was this book going to be different? How would you say that the book is different for people who haven't seen it yet, compared to the other books that are out there?
Yeah, well, you know, I'll tell you what, there's some really smart people who've taken a crack at this. Mark Bendin, who's one of the primary researchers at Texas A&M about children sitting, has written a great book. Dr. James Levine of the Mayo Clinic, his book, you know, he's the guy who coined the term sitting is the new smoking. That's Dr. James Levine, right. You know, who's an obesity researcher. And the problem, I think, is that when we shout at people, you know, sitting's going to kill you. You know, you're like, eh, I'm not dead and I'm sitting here watching my TV. So what are you talking about? You know, it doesn't capture people's imagination. The same way injury prevention doesn't sell mobilization or taking care of your tissues. Like, I'm not injured. Nothing hurts. I just PR'd on my bench. Like, what the heck are you talking about? So what we're seeing is that if we, one, make people aware of the reality of the research coming out, because we need to give people context. And that is the whole sort of gist of the research, that we have seen that last week, a new research came out that said, for the first time in our history of our nation, there are more obese people than non-obese people, right? That last, I think it was last week or the week before, the WHO came out, or, you know, basically said that diabetes has quadrupled in the United States in the last 4 years or last 10 years, quadrupled.
Wow.
And the WHO, World Health Organization, is saying that sedentary lifestyle, which is defined as sitting more than 6 hours a day, and it's easy to sit 6 hours a day. You got an hour commute, that's 2 hours. Boom. You know, you sit down for dinner with your family, that's another hour. Now you're at 3 hours of sitting. You haven't even sat at work. You haven't sat in a meeting. You haven't sat on the bus. Like, it's easy to slip into this sedentary lifestyle threshold. And they're saying that it's the fourth biggest global killer annually. Australia has put sedentary lifestyle as its number one public health problem. And what we then say, people are like, oh, okay, I didn't realize the scope. You know, because it's not just sitting immediately is going to kill me. It's that, hey, sitting is this allegory for not moving. And what we're trying to show people is, hey, one is that you can actually be more lucid, more productive, feel better, you know, burn a billion. I mean, literally, there's a little research that Juliet did where she basically burns an additional 90,000 calories a year by standing at her desk, or she can run 22 marathons. So she can stand at her desk or run 22 marathons. And I'll tell you what she does. She stands and works, right?
Right.
And if, you know, the research is about like test scores, kids are literally scoring like 200 points higher on the SAT when they take it in a standing position. Their brains work better. And so what we've tried to do is point to all the positive effects of being a human. Here's how we should move. In fact, standing like a cashier doesn't work. Someone just told me this study that I hadn't heard before, but I believe it, because this guy was like, dude, they just did this study where nurses who are moving all day long, right, compared to cashiers. Cashiers actually had an additional liter of blood because of the stasis or the pooling as standing. So they were standing and they had to, like, because so much blood pooled in the legs, their body actually had to manufacture more blood than the same cohort of nurses, which is really amazing how good we are at adapting and failure to sort of recognize that the goal isn't necessarily to stand like a statue. The goal is to be in a constantly dynamic, moving environment, right?
Right.
And so, you know, if we can keep pointing people in the direction of make sure that you're seeing this for what it is, that you're, you know, it's okay to squat down or sit on the ground. It's totally okay. And you're like, oh, by the way, in cultures that toilet on the ground, sleep on the ground, fall risk in the elderly drops to almost zero. Isn't that weird? That's that there's crazy. Very little hip disease and lumbar disease in people who actually can squat ass to grass, right? So, and I apologize for the ASS word there. So, no worries. But the idea here is that, you know, once we make people aware And also how simple it is. You don't need a fancy desk or a treadmill. You need a place to put your foot, just like the Captain Morgan's pose. You've got to get out of extension. We want you to constantly be changing your position, moving a little bit. And what you see is that you can put a, you know, an Amazon box on top of your counter or on top of your desk and immediately impact your life. And what you'll realize is, wow, I'm weak. My feet are tired. You know, like you, what we're seeing is that we're not very conditioned to stand. And just like we transition down to a heel with less differential in running shoes, slowly and gradually, we're advocating that people adopt this plan slowly and gradually.
Yeah. And seeing the book, so I do some standing. I'm fortunate that there's a certain location in my house. It's almost like a stand-up desk. There's like a barrier between our dining room and our family room. And I can stand there and do some writing and computer work. So I'm not always sitting in my home office here. You know, this is where I do the podcast and things like that. So it's really good. But what I do notice is what you just said is that you do get fatigued when you're standing in a certain position. So another thing that I took out of the book in the past couple of days since I got it is that I should be changing my position more often. And there was a picture, I think, in there of Juliet with her foot up on a ball as she's standing there. And just all these different positions. And I wasn't doing that. So again, another thing that will impact me directly is making sure that I'm optimizing my position and position changing frequently as I'm standing up.
Well, and you know, one of the things that, you know, we came to this because we were working with a lot of universities and there were university football teams that were having lots of orthopedic dysfunction. A lot of low back pain, short anterior hip, stiff quads, knee pain, short calf. And if I said to you, just take your elbow, bring it up so your forearm is parallel to the ground, right? Flex your hand away like you're kind of walking like an Egyptian and just hold this position for the next 8 hours. Let me know what happens to your elbow. Let me know what happens to your wrist. Let me know what happens to, you know what I mean? Right. Like it's shocking when you think about being in this mid-range position. I mean, your tissues are going to get stiff to hold that. So we had them just do a little, you know, anecdotal survey of the team. And the team was sitting 10 to 14 hours a day. You know, these were kids playing Xbox, sitting in meetings. When we cut that down, we saw better hip extension, right? Less stiffness in the tissues, less, you know, trunk, you know, compromises from short psoas, short iliacus, short QL, right? Better breathing patterns. You know, my daughter's school is an elementary school. When she was a first grader, we noticed halfway through the first of the year, you know, and I'll be honest, you know, Brian McKenzie is one of my best friends, right? Who really taught me how to run correctly and to think about running and love running, you know, and what I noticed was that all the kindergartners run perfectly. They run, they land on the ball of their foot. You know, they're natural runners, whether it's forefoot or midfoot. I mean, they don't heel strike is what I'm saying, right?
Right.
Heel strike or no heel strike. And halfway through the first grade, kids start heel striking. And you're like, whoa, you just changed a primary motor pattern that's existed for 6 to 7 years. And now you've adopted a completely different motor pattern. What is going on? And that's shocking because you can't, you know, that's a lifetime of being rewired incorrectly. You're not tapping to your elasticness of your Achilles. We know you can heel strike for a while, but you can't heel strike barefoot, right? You can't run fast heel striking. So what we looked at was like the only intervention that we popped in our heads was this shocking sitting load. That was this insidious environmental load that we were starting to expose kids to. And then we extrapolate that up and man, it is a gigantic, big problem.
Now you talk about in the book, certainly there's so many problems with sitting, but I think one of the quotes was sitting is an orthopedic disaster. Let's talk about the specific problems. And you just touched on some of them.
Well, what we should say first and foremost is that we're never, ever saying these sustained postures guarantee to cause pain. That's not true. You know, the problem with the human being and also the gift of the human being is that we are incredibly robust and we have amazing, sorry about that. We have amazing software that allows us to buffer, you know, amazing hardware that allows us to buffer literally anything. I mean, and you know, so one of the concepts here is that we need to make sure that people are aware that we're not looking at the next 5 years. We're looking at the next 100 years because that's how long we're all going to live. Right. And when we start getting specific, are you pain free? Yes or no? Some of those early questions we ask. And the answer, most of the time, people are like, no, I live with pain. My back hurts, my knee hurts, my Achilles hurts. Right. And so we start asking questions. Well, what is going on that you're violating this basic tenet of human beings, which should be pain free and you're going to live a long time? And what we're seeing is if we express Because sitting in and of itself may not be a problem, especially if you all you do is a little bicep curl and you get on the elliptical machine. Never expose, you know, you don't have to expose your hip to extension. If you just go to SoulCycle and think that's fitness, not skill, then you can just go from a sitting position exercising back to a sitting position, right?
Right.
And maybe someday you're like, I have shoulder pain or my back hurts or my neck hurts. I don't understand what's going on. What am I, you know, clench my jaw. What we need to understand is that most of our orthopedic problems that aren't pathological in nature and aren't, you know, catastrophic. So I haven't been injured or I don't have shoulder cancer, right? Then most of them are a skill or movement related problem. And when we look at the human being as a self-organizing system, right? It's a very complex system, but also underneath that, if I have aberrant motor patterns or positions that I adopt as habit, because remember, practice doesn't make perfect, practice makes permanent. The positions I adopt most of the time are the positions I'll reflect under stress or my default shapes. That's called skill, right? And what we're not thinking about is organization of the spine, relationship of head to trunk as skill. So yes, I know you can round your back and deadlift, but that's not the most efficient way to deadlift the most weight, right? So that's sort of a dead end position. But if you sit in the chair with your pelvis tucked under you, sitting on your coccyx, pelvic floor turned off, diaphragm compromised, shoulders internally rotated, what I can tell you is if you adopt those positions for hundreds of hours a week, right? I mean, literally like 8-10 hours a day, you know, 70 hours a week, just to say just sitting, right? That is a huge amount of self-organized criticality that eventually I guarantee you will show up. And that's why we have so much physical therapy and chiropractic and osteopaths, and we see so many massage because we are living with this dysfunction. And it's important to recognize that we're never saying static posture is perfect, but the moving, breathing correctly, changing my shape is enough to reset. If you flex the fishing pole over all the time, the fishing pole is designed to handle that, but the resting load for that fishing pole is straight up and down. I mean, that is a Stuart McGill reference, right?
Right.
And what we need to understand, who, you know, is a great physical therapist, and what we need to understand then is saying, hey, look, we think that there's a good position, a more optimally aligned position that doesn't necessarily cause pain, but that improves function. And we can, again, spin out. Adult diaper industry in the United States, $1.2 billion. We have a bladder incontinence problem of a $1.2 billion industry. I need to stop even talking about performance. I need to get into the adult diaper business. Well, why does that pelvic floor not work as effectively? Like, what's going on? We're not designed to pee ourselves. That's not normal. Well, what I can tell you is if your pelvis is cranked over either forward or slouched backwards, pelvic floor musculature gets turned off. Right. And we start to see the musculature get tight, trying to protect the same stiffness that we get in the shoulders or the back, trying to hold the head up. You know, what ends up happening is if you don't weight bear through the pelvis, i.e. through the hips and standing, then that endopelvic fascia, the connective tissue from the pelvis up, right, doesn't wind up and support the musculature. And so we've just knocked out this huge fascial support system. You know, and what we need to see is that these are seems like hyper focused, very complex problems, but relating to what? To the fact that when I sit down, my diaphragm function is compromised. Don't believe me? If you're sitting listening to this, take a big breath. What you'll see is that you'll take a big breath up in your chest, up in your neck. That's a stress breathing pattern. That fires up cortisol. That's inefficient. That's, you know, we're not even accessing our diaphragm so that we can, you know, stimulate vagus nerve tone. I mean, like, check the box, but come back to the thing that matters most, which is we are movement animals. That is the thing. And so we can become hyper detailed in our understanding. So we can go deep into the molecular level, but we never need to lose track of the fact that the most difficult changes to explain are environment, social cognitive behavior, right? And we all, like, I can understand the physics of aerodynamics, but I can't go back and reconstitute the butterfly. I need to make sure I understand the butterfly in the context of the world, not try to explain the phenomenon around the lift on the butterfly's wings, because that's useful to know, but doesn't change the butterfly-ness.
Nice. I love a lot that you said there. That was a mouthful. But the we are movement animals is so true. And that's one thing that is so consistent with all the interviews that we've done so far is, you know, you keep talking about how the body loves to move. You know, the body is designed to move. So this is a great spot to go into the four simple guidelines that you outlined in the book, which I think are absolutely fantastic, because when it comes down to it, it really comes down to these four simple things. So the first guideline is to reduce optional sitting. So can you talk about that?
Well, you know, what we realize is that, you know, again, people are like, they got to get their kids to school. They got to make breakfast. They're worried about, you know, the promotion, what's happening at work. My mom's sick. Ah, I got to try. Right. So what we can't do is add more complexity to people's lives. That is a recipe for what we're currently doing. I mean, girls are tearing their ACLs at 6 to 8 times the rate of men. No problem, right? We're winning that, right? ACL injuries in children up 400% under 12. That's cool. It's totally cool. It's like we're winning. So what we've done, it's not that we haven't taken, we've added complexity. We're measuring more. We're tracking more data, right? But what we want to do is simplify. And one of the simple principles is that if you have an option to stand, when you could sit, make that option. And what you'll see is that it's not the standing, it's the movement. And by the way, Tadasana in yoga is the correct standing posture. And what we have failed to do as a medical community is go back into our movement traditions, right? Because you're like, there's no science behind karate. You're like, well, they figured some stuff out. You know what I mean? And you're like, where's the science behind yoga? Well, people have been talking about stable shoulders for a long time. You know, if you hear Greg Cook say something like, if you can't breathe in a position, you don't own that position, right? I'm like, amen, brother, comma. Boy, the yogis have been talking about that for a long time. That's why they put you in downward dog and make you take a big breath, huh? You know, you get into Warrior One, you hold your breath, and the yoga teacher's like, what are you doing? You're like, stabilizing. And so when we simplify it, when we give people the option of just that one or zero, oh, you know, I'm sitting on the, I can stand, I'll get my chair away, or, hey, I can take the stairs, or I'll walk, or, you know, what you'll realize is that there's a lot of optional sitting. And then that means that we've buffered the non-optional sitting, because it's impossible to go into a board meeting and be the only person standing. You're going to look like a jerk.
Right.
Second is that if you fly or commute in a car, right, or go to a nice dinner with your partner, I guarantee you at some point you're going to be forced to sit, because that's the environment, and the environment doesn't fit the physiology. So this gives us a choice to opt in or opt out, and that's a really simple rule. If people just were like, oh, I'm sitting here, but I don't need to sit here, right? We could stand at the counter and have a coffee instead of sitting at the table and have a coffee.
All right. So another thing you talked about there too was sitting on the ground, which I thought was interesting, versus sitting in a chair or a couch.
Well, what we're seeing is if you sit on the ground, a couple things happen. One is that you end up taking your body through a greater range of motion, right? Where you've created an instantaneously more rich movement environment, right?
Right.
And, you know, you're taking that hip through full range. And for example, I had this conversation with my friends, Mark Bell, who's a world champion powerlifter. And I was like, hey, Mark, when's the last time you actually like took your knee all the way to your chest? You know, and he's like, Vietnam, probably. And, you know, because he's like, he sits at the edge of the bed, he gets in the car, he sits at the table, sits on the toilet, right? Squats to parallel, you know what I mean?
Right.
And he lost it because he wasn't using it. He wasn't telling his nervous system that was a valuable position. And also, when you sit on the ground, you're not sitting on your femurs, you're sitting on your ischial tuberosities, the part of your pelvis that is weight bearing. And when you sit cross-legged and in those shapes, one of the things that's happening is you are winding up your pelvis to be in a more stable position. And when people can't sit crisscross applesauce, because a lot of people who are listening probably can't, it's a red flag that your hips are so tight that you can't even sit on the ground. So what do you think is going to happen? Are you going to get less tight or more tight, more restricted, less restricted as you age? The number one reason we end up in nursing homes is we can't get up off the ground independently. And there's that big research study that came out. I know you've seen it. Can you get up off the ground cross-legged without a point of contact as a predictor of mortality?
Yes.
And, you know, and I'm like, whoa, that's a really terrible position to get up off the ground in, but okay, you should be able to do it, right?
Right.
And I think what's interesting then is when we, for example, at our standing, all standing moving schools, our daughters are at the first all standing / moving schools in the world. They don't have chairs at their desks. But the kids are free to sit on the ground if they fatigue, because we do get tired, and it's okay. And if you sit on the ground, work on the ground, what you'll see is that it creates a lot more movement and you have structures that better support it. A chair doesn't support the physiology, but the physiology does start to be supported. You know, the mechanics of the hip, the myofascial systems, when you start moving from the ground.
Yeah, I like that. I like that a lot. So I'm glad that you talked about that in the book. And it certainly made me, again, think differently in the past couple of days, just since taking a look at a desk.
Well, and you know what we can do is, so example, you don't have to get rid of your couch. Right? I love my leather mid-century modern couch.
Right.
But what I do is I sit cross-legged on, you know, or I sit on the ground and lean up again. So once again, I'm in these supported, relaxed positions, but I'm not dangling off creating more sitting patterning, which is difficult to undo, especially when we're talking about performance, right? If you're happy being 50% physiology and you're pain-free, you have that right. But don't pretend like that your incomplete, your rounded upper back is not going to limit your overhead shoulder position. And when we extrapolate that to our pilots, we extrapolate that to our Marines, people who wear body armor, our police officers, suddenly your logic does not hold, right? Because part of our idea here is that we have to be able to scale these positions up and down. I have to be able to load them. I have to say, do these positions transfer? And if you're slouched over, it doesn't transfer. And if that's your predominant position, it doesn't transfer. So it's important that we're looking at all of these other aspects of the world when we make these statements like, it doesn't matter if you sit. It doesn't matter if you dangle your head forward. Of course, it doesn't matter. You're designed to be able to look down. But do you think it's okay to close off your windpipe, shut down your diaphragm, and dangle your head 6 inches out in front of your center of mass for 4 hours a day?
It's crazy.
Because that's adults are spending 2 to 4 hours a day on their smartphones in a new position that we haven't ever adopted that much time, right? You know, the Kaiser Family Foundation found that kids across any socioeconomic status were averaging about 11, this is up to like age 14 or 15, 11 hours of screen time a day.
Wow. That's crazy. Let's move on to guideline number two, and that is for every 30 minutes you sit, move for 2 minutes.
Well, so the idea here is when you find yourself engrossed, and I really like 20 minutes better than 30 minutes, but we're also trying to be realists, right? Is that if you can think to yourself, okay, I have to sit and I have been sitting. If a little alarm goes off in your brain to fidget, you need to fidget. And if you look at your positions in the chair at work where you're constantly shifting and what your brain is telling you is that position is stale, time to move on to a new position. So one of the things that we have built in through our kids' desks is a thing called the fidget bar. Okay. Right. So this desk that we like has a bar that swings on the bottom. So when the kid puts their foot up on it, automatically they adopt the Captain Morgan pose. They're blocked into a better position. They can lean on the desk. But then because that foot is in constant motion, we're on to the muscle system, the bony system, the fascial system. We're changing sort of predominant systems and allows us to be in constant small motion. So, you know, the idea here is that if you've been static, get up, squeeze your butt, put your arms over your head, take 10 big breaths. But getting people to realize, hey, I've been compromised. And if you're a ninja, you could sit and grind for an hour and be like, oh my gosh, I haven't blinked in an hour. And it's really easy to get sucked in because we've sort of lost that innate feeling that I need to move, that I'm not aware. And if you don't believe me, go into the gym and ask someone to pick something up with a flat back off the ground. Just lift this ball up off the ground and watch them totally round. And you're like, hey, we all agree that you should keep a flat back. And they're like, my back is flat. And you're like, actually, you look like a broken rainbow, right? And the thing is that people can't feel it because we're so shut down. You know, and one of the reasons we love the myofascial rolling is just wakes up the proprioceptors. But we have literally insulated ourselves against the feelings of moving and the innate drive to move to the extent that we can override all those things and we can sit in these static postures for hours and hours and hours and hours. So if you're on the airplane, sit on the aisle, get up every 30 minutes, be that annoying girl who has to like right. Take a little water break. Makes a huge difference.
You talked about the Captain Morgan pose a couple of times. Can you describe that? And I know I saw that somewhere in the book. I was trying to flip through it, but is there any way to describe what that looks like?
Yeah. You know, if you've ever, like, there are these places where adults go sometimes. They're called bars or pubs. And you may have heard of them. Sure. And they serve adult beverages there. But a long time ago, someone figured out that bar height is different than counter height. And bar height meant that when people saddle up, they put their elbows on there and they were in a position where they could support a standing posture. And remember, posture is a prissy word for position of the spine. That's really what we're describing. So we should stop using posture because it de-emphasizes spinal position, spinal mechanics. So when people adopt a better position at the bar, you know, the bartenders figured out because people backs would still ache, and they figured out that if there was a rail at the bottom of the pub, rail at the bottom of the bar, and people put up their foot up there, they would stand and drink long. And what was really happening is that, and we say this, you know, it's not a standing station to have a place to put your foot. It takes a lot of the extension load out. So the short hips, the tight quads, the short anterior high quads of the psoas and the iliacus, these structures tend to pull our pelvis forward passively. And that is something we've got to fight against. And so we have to use a lot of other musculature to balance that out. And putting one foot up takes all that load out. And that's why you'll see people stand like storks. They'll put one foot up, or you'll see people standing and adopting positions where one leg is out to the side. what they're trying to do is get out of the extension through the low back. And you can see crazy positions and body behaviors trying to stop that. And so what happens with the Captain Morgan pose, or just putting your foot up on a box between 6 and 12 inches, is that will make it more easily for you to normalize your pelvic lumbar relationship and maintain a position of uprightness. I mean, and you can, if you don't believe me, run this experiment for yourself. Do a heavy deadlift session. Go and deadlift your brains out. Do the Dan John 315 for every 30 seconds for 30 minutes test. Do that workout, right? It's great, great, great fitness test. And then go to a bar and stand around and literally just stand there, and you'll realize that your beer is not very cold. No one's very attractive. No one is saying anything funny, right? But then as soon as you put your foot up, you'll be like, oh, this is the best beer I've ever had. All of these people are so charming. That man and that woman is so attractive. And what's happened is you've just taken the load out of your spine, and lo and behold, you'll feel that. And that's what we want people to understand. Wow. We want to create environments that allow us to constantly move and adopt positions that enable us to manage some of the background programming that we've inadvertently put in.
Well, man, I mean, like I said earlier, I think that was the missing component for me, is when I was doing prolonged standing around the house when I'm writing or something like that, is I wasn't doing that. So I wasn't bringing that leg up on a ball or a slant board or anything like that.
It makes a huge difference. You know, we work with an amazing, and this isn't giving anything away, but you know, Bob Weir of the Grateful Dead is trains at our gym, is a good friend of ours, right? And he was, you know, he's an athlete, he sprints, but he's getting 70 and he's a little bit extension sensitive, right? In his low back. And what we did for his last tour was we gave him a bunch of props. And so he has a ball on stage. He has a box jump that he can lean against. And what we've done is created an environment for him where he can be playing these marathon Grateful Dead, performances, and simultaneously be trying to take some of the load out of his back, that he would have just standing and singing. So we've created an environment where he can constantly move and adjust his position as he needs. That's exactly what we're advocating for everyone else.
Excellent. So you talk a lot about position, which is the third guideline, is to optimize position. Now, I wanted to ask you something. So for people that are sitting, and I know you've probably been asked this question before, but the arm in external rotation, how do you recommend getting into a good position with the arm if someone is sitting and preventing the internal rotation and that rounded shoulder position?
Well, the first thing to understand is that we don't advocate for, people are like, scapula, backing down. I'm like, you're not really wired for your scapula. that means that I should memorize my scapula position for every movement I do, right? No. So first and foremost is that if you're rounded through your upper back, it's going to be very difficult for you to manage a good shoulder, an organized shoulder position. So let's define that. So if you look at your shoulders and the front of your shoulder is in front of your pec, and sometimes you'll see it that the front of the shoulder is in front of your nipple, that's a red flag that you are living in the front of the shoulder socket. Your shoulder is not really in contact with the joint surface, right? You're living in the short, and then your external rotators are holding on. Your pecs have gotten short. Your traps are in a terrible position. Your elbows are flared, right? So it's basically like your thumbs are pointing at each other and your elbows are out, which is exactly how people do bad pushups. So if you look down and you can see that there's a dent in your pec versus your pec or your breast being flat and broad and your shoulders being organized where they belong, then the first thing to do is to start is by making sure that your rib cage is stacked neatly over your lumbar spine, which is why we start with the pelvis in our model on the chair. Let's try to get a neutral pelvis. Let's keep the rib cage down. And then if you put your hands out to the side, there's a couple ways to do this. If you put your hands straight out to the side and turn your palms all the way up to the sky, you'll see that what's really happened is that you created a bunch of rotation externally at the shoulder. So you can keep your shoulders forward and try to turn your palms up, but not only do I want to turn the palms up, but I want to turn the elbow pits up. So now that is a rotated stable shoulder position. And if you brought your hands by your side and just flipped your hands over, you'll find that you can adopt that's the wound up shoulder position you should be in. So, or if I just turn my palms up like I was sitting in lotus pose, right? So that the shoulder is winding up, it's screwing into the back of the socket, then just flip my forearms over. Now I'm in a stable mechanical position. So again, let's go back to the movement practice. The yogi sat in lotus position. When you sat with your palms up facing that classic lotus sitting position, what was really happening is they figured out that organizing the shoulder into that shape made a stable head thoracic spine relationship because the shoulder was stable. So it was easier to balance my head neatly over my trunk so I could sit and shut up, right? That allowed me to breathe more effectively and be more organized. And if you round forward, just go ahead and round and see what happens to your back. So your shoulders go, your back goes, your head kind of kinks. I guarantee you, if you sit there for 20 minutes, you're going to burn like the devil.
Right.
And so what they figured out was, boy, we better train this position and adopt that this lotus is fully externally rotated, which is a stable mechanical position, which is also the anatomical position. So if you look at the anatomical position, palms are facing forward, shoulder blades. I like to say, and this is from Ida Rolf and Rolfing, in standing, I want to see the mass and the bulk of your rhomboids and traps. So if you took a picture, someone took a picture of your back, I should see how jacked your back is. And if your pecs, your shoulders are forward in front of your pecs, and I can't see the musculature, the rhomboid and trap bulk between your scapula, I can tell from across the room you're in disorganized shape.
Wow. That's a good visual. And they had good concept to understand the importance of the shoulder musculature in relation to position.
Yeah. And, you know, think about it. People are coming up all the time with these rotator cuff problems. I'm like, well, I appreciate that it looks like a rotator cuff weakness or rotator cuff pathology, but let's start by putting the shoulder into a position where the rotator cuff can work effectively. And what I like to say is, you can imagine your rotator cuff is like an octopus that swam into a shell, backed into a shell, and that shell is your scapula. And then the octopus arms steer, position, stabilize, move the head of your humerus around. But sometimes if you flip the shell over, so all of a sudden the shell is flipped over, that's your scapula winging forward or tipping, or you rounding. The octopus has really weird place to live and steer the shoulder because the shoulder stays the same. Thank goodness, so that we can feed ourselves, right? And having that degree of freedom at the scapula means I can organize and manipulate the world infinitely. But we confuse that degree of freedom with resting habitus, resting state. And I guarantee you, and as everyone has said this from Erwan Lacour all the way up to Ido Portal, Ido, all the way up to, you know, Gray Cook, if you did more hanging and pulling, if you actually had to use your shoulders like a human being would by climbing and foraging and lifting and throwing, there's only one position your shoulder would be in, and that's in a more organic position, the same one that Leonardo da Vinci describes.
Kelly, what do you recommend for, let's talk about the spine. So finding the optimal spinal position while sitting. How do you recommend, I'm just trying to think for some type of cue. Is it just awareness? Is it habit development when you find yourself slouching and not in a good position?
Well, some of it is, you know, it is practice, skill practice. But how about this? Do we have people, let's just go back in the strength conditioning world. Do you just tell people to bend down and grab the bar on a deadlift and then try to get flat?
No.
That doesn't work. Right. In fact, what we see is that when we're trying to reduce movement variability, right? Skill. So we do the same thing every single time. We have the basic setups, right? I'm in my most organized, physiologic, sane self. What we do is we try to organize from the top. And oh, by the way, all of the masters teach Olympic lifting from a standing position, from the hang shape. Why? Because it's the easiest position to mitigate the effects of missing range of motion, and it's the easiest position to optimize head position, spine position, shoulders position. So they teach everything from the hang. Hang power snatch, hang muscle snatch, right? You know, what we get is we start to see hang clean, hang power clean. Like those ideas are taught from that upright position because there are very few loads on the spine. So what we've done is realize, hey, if I try to get you to reconstitute a spinal position, you're just going to do a whole bunch of crazy stuff in your low back trying to get yourself in what you think is an upright position. So instead, let's not start with a type one error, which is sitting. Let's start in standing. So let's teach you to stand and be organized. Again, movement tradition, Tadasana, deadlift setup. You know, Eric Cressy loves to deadlift from this thing he calls the Cressy salute. So he squeezes his butt, his feet are straight, his arms are up like a zombie, right?
Right.
Why do the powerlifters put their arms up like a zombie? Well, that takes the internal rotation load out of the shoulder and allows them to get better upper back extension. Oh, so they've realized that with hands by your side, there's this load induced on the upper back from the shoulder positioning that makes it difficult for you to stabilize. So they put the spine into a really good shape. And by the way, if you take that zombie position, you know, turn it out to the side, we're in that same shoulder position we just talked about. Right. And now in standing, I can achieve a more organized spinal shape by squeezing my butt, by screwing my hips into the ground, by creating some abdominal trunk tension to stabilize. Now, maintain that shape and sit down. And now you have a reference point. Ah, this is what it feels like. And what you're going to see is that sitting straight up and down is a difficult task, and your keyboard's way out in front of you and you can't use the back of the chair. So you're going to have to tip forward, and tipping forward means that's like being in the bottom of an air squat where I'm leaning forward. And boy, pretty soon I'm going to slouch and round, because that's easier and costs less energetically to hold that position because I have these tissues. I'll just hang on the meat instead. Got Stand it. Up.
Change positions and keep moving. I mean, that's the bottom line.
And it's okay to put skill back into all of those things, because we don't think, you know, I don't think we need to just say, let's go back 10 years in strength and conditioning. You know, who was squatting a lot? Not a lot of people. You know, like Dan John and Greg Cook were like, hey, here's this goblet squat. Let's goblet squat. And now when you go to a Perform Better Summit, you see a lot of people squatting. They're doing the goblet squat. You know, 10 years ago, Greg Glassman was just ripping his hair out because he was like, hey, how come no one is deadlifting or squatting? And guess what now? People are deadlifting, squatting. So now that we're doing it, now we can start overlaying some skill on top of it, right? Because, you know, that means now that, hey, it's okay to put the skill back into movement. It's not just fitnessing. And what we've confused is fitnessing solves all problems. Strength solves all problems, but it doesn't. What we need to do is realize that movement is an acquired skill and practiced skill. Don't believe me? Go to a yoga class, go to a Pilates class, right? And you're going to get hammered on your really bad technique. Right. That's right. It. You know, yeah. Show up at Diane Fu's Olympic lifting, you know, class at our gym, and you're going to get hammered on your poor technique during the application. So it's not about working harder, right? It's about adding skill. And we need to be able to translate that skill down into innocuous, unloaded positions, but those are still skilled. You know, we don't have a problem when we teach beginners. We don't worry about their pelvis, let's say butt winking. We see it as a problem when they get heavier, right? And deadlifting with rounded backs. But in the beginning, it's okay. I've never seen anyone herniate with a PVC pipe when we're teaching deadlifting, right? So the problem is we confuse this unloaded state with the fact that, hey, this really inefficient position is going to transfer up to speed or load. Don't believe me? Let's go move my friend's piano and we'll see how good your skill transfers up. And that's what we're trying to tell people, is that we have a chance to become skilled movers so that skill transfers infinitely.
So maybe all the skill acquisition goes back to the fourth guideline, which is to perform 10 to 15 minutes of daily maintenance every day.
Well, you know, what we're trying to have people do is say, if you move really, really well, it takes little effort, and you have a good movement practice. It takes a little effort to maintain. You might, you know, your tissues might get a little stiff sometimes, right? You might overdo it. But the most of us sort of move inefficiently. And when we move inefficiently, it causes a lot of internal strain on the system, where fascia gets tight, joint capsules get restricted. And what we have found is if people perform 10 to 15 minutes of self-mobilization, which isn't just press and guess, initially, it's okay just to roll on a ball and find a problem.
Right.
But ultimately, we want to make sure that people are thinking about that positional competency and mobilizing as the same, that we're always mobilizing to improve a position. It's not just about if I have healthy quads, it's all magic. It's if I have normal quads and healthy quads and my tissue slide, I can squat more efficiently. I can run more efficiently. Those positions improve. Mechanical efficiency improves, right? So I think that's where we want people to understand is ultimately, if you spend 10 or 15 minutes a night, it can help you sleep better, right? You can address common myofascial pain. Like, you can take that on for yourself. You don't have to live with that. You don't have to medicate with it, right? You can start a really powerful conversation about your body and about reclaiming the body. And I guess guarantee you have 10 minutes a night to work on this.
Yeah.
And we don't have to fix everything all at once. You know, there are a lot of people out there who have these really crazy programs that takes 2 hours to go through or 3 hours to go through. And for me, that's not scalable. It's not tenable. So you've just knocked out 98% of the population who can't spend 3 hours a day on their movement practice, right? And so what we need to do is give people good guidelines to be able to systematically address their tissue restriction and movement restrictions. And that includes 10 or 15 minutes a day of soft tissue work. Easy.
Now, on the flip side of that, can we overdo the mobility work? Are there dangers of spending too much time on mobility?
Well, let's be honest. The dangers you'll see is that people will go run with chronic knee pain, right, and collapsed ankles and arch supports, and they're afraid to roll on a ball in their quads. You know, I'm like, come on, like, let's set it up. First and foremost, we try to create guidelines for people that help them not overmobilize, because it's a tissue. It'll bruise if you smash the crap out of it for an hour, right? So let's do this. First and foremost, let's create a few guidelines. If you roll on any part of your body, it should not hurt. So no part of your body should be painful to compression. That's powerful, because when you're basically creating a localized compression, laying on a ball or a foam roll or something like that, a rolling pin, what you've done is you've created high tension in an area. That's an allegory for stiffness in the entire system.
Okay.
So your body should be able to handle that compression and movement without pain. And that's shocking, because most people, the first time they roll, you know, they roll on a white foam roller. They get it like Walmart, right?
Right.
And that white foam roller was invented as a pool toy. It's a pool toy. And if that causes you discomfort in your calves are a hot mess. That's what we want people to understand. But also, we understand that that's where you are. It's no value judgment, just that your calves are a hot mess. Let's start there. So shouldn't be painful. Two is it also shouldn't be stiff. There's a lot of tissues that become very fibrotic. You know, I encourage everyone listening to go to Gil Headley. Gil Headley has the most amazing resource on the internet, and it's about live dissection. So he is the greatest, most preeminent anatomist I have ever seen. You know, when we talk about the fuzz or breaking up the adhesions, right, the soft connective tissue, you'll see when he goes in and dissects lungs, it's shocking to see how tacked down the lungs are to the viscera, to the walls. And right, these are all should be sliding surfaces, right? And oh, there's that sliding surface language, which is his language. You know, and the sliding surface concept is that, like, you should be like layers of warm silk sliding over steel springs. But a lot of us get really stiff because we don't move and the body protects itself with fascia and connective tissue. And sometimes those things aren't painful. But if you come across a piece of your body that feels like beef jerky, that beef jerky does not stretch or glide. So you're going to have to chew it up. And that's why we need people to understand, hey, it shouldn't be painful. B, it shouldn't feel like beef jerky. Now, here's the key. We've found that if we limit the session to 10 or 15 minutes, and usually I have two sides, that automatically stops the clock. So I'm done. I get as much work as I can in 10 or 15 minutes, and I'll get the rest of it tomorrow. And I'll get the rest of it the day after that. And then if I have a conversation with myself for the next month, I'm going to get dose and response, dose and response. So Kelly, how do I keep from going too deep? Simple. If you can't take a full breath in and a full breath out, you're going too deep. How simple is that? Because we see people foam roll and it's like literally they're bracing for a punch. I got it. Right. And they're holding their breath. Sure. They're firing up their sympathetic nervous system. Yeah. You're telling yourself, dude, you're under threat. There's no way you're going to access those myofascial pieces or some of that neural tone. So you need to have full excursion of the breath. And if you can't take your full breath all the way in, I mean all the way in and to the very bottoms of your diaphragm all the way out, you're going too deep. Very simple.
So intensity matters, duration matters.
Sure. Yeah. But we don't have to veil it. And we also don't have to put it behind a paywall of modern for-profit medicine. There are things that we believe that everyone should be able to handle. You know, if your Achilles gets tight, you should not have to go, you know, your heel hurts a little bit. You shouldn't freak out and go see a surgeon. You should take a crack at making sure that the skin slides, that your calf is not stiff, that the bottom of your foot isn't stiff. You should have basic templates for that. And that's our mission, is to move. And in the back of the book of Deskbound, we've got all of these things. We're trying to move that non-skilled care out from behind the wall and make it ubiquitous.
Do you have a favorite mobility tool for most people?
Whatever you have lying around. You know, there are more expensive tools. There are less expensive tools. But, you know, literally I was teaching the Marines and the guy like unscrews a grenade, like a training grenade, right? And he hands me the steel training grenade. He's like, this is the best lacrosse ball ever. And I was like, yes, it is.
Wow.
And that's very aggressive that you're going to roll on a grenade. But he's like, I want you to take it home. So I have a grenade sitting. And like, I tell you what, you put your leg on a steel grenade case, I guarantee you, you're going to find all the tissue restrictions, right?
Wow.
You know, what people don't realize is that, you know, you can use any ball. A lacrosse ball is our example. We are the people who popularize. I'm the person who popularized use of the lacrosse ball, which they sell at airports now, you know, but you know, those things are about $1 a piece. And what we thought was, hey, it's too big. It's too small. Of course, it's too hard. It's too soft, but it's cheap. And if you lose it, you don't freak out. So There is a multi-million dollar industry, probably tens of millions of fascial tools out there, right? Of myofascial release. It may be a $1 billion industry at this point, probably. Yeah. But the most important thing is, you know, use what you have where you are. You know, isn't that sound like Dan John?
Totally.
All right. And you know, my friend Jill Miller, you know, like literally with other athletes, we'll use our shin. So, you know, like someone's like, oh, my psoas is lit up. I'm like, I'll bend my knee up, have them lay on my knee, and they can start to work on that psoas, breaking that psoas tone. You know, if you lay down and I grab your shin, you know, I can put your calves and mash them back and forth on my shin, and my shin becomes a roller. So I think that's what's really amazing. You know, we really advocate for partner smashing, just, you know, smash someone's quads out, you know, put a little pressure on them with your foot. And literally the body, you don't need any equipment to begin a conversation here.
Yeah, good stuff. All right, now here's one of my burning questions. And the question is, why isn't exercise alone enough? So there's some studies out there showing that sitting negates the effects of exercise. Now, I actually have not read this, any of these studies, and I'm a study guy, but what is your take on that?
Well, my take on it is, you know, the smart people doing the research, right, have shown that basically we can't overcome the physiologic implications of sitting, and that exercising for an hour doesn't negate the fact that you basically engage in a sedentary lifestyle. And that is one of the greatest sort of misunderstandings, because people are doing the right thing and then they go back and they're sedentary. And it's not enough to overcome all of the impacts on your physiology. And I'm talking about the biochemical impacts, the neuroendocrine impacts, the mechanical impacts. You just can't undo it in that hour of exercise. And so if you exercise, like for example, you know, we love, you know, compression socks. We're such a huge fan, especially if you have a job where you have to like wear cute clothes, you know, like you have to wear a suit, or, you know, you can sneak on some compression socks underneath that suit. But when you're forced to sit and you can't be moving, you know, you're not allowing those, your feet and calves to congest. If you don't have time for a cool down, which a lot of us don't, we should cool down, right? We should bring our tissues down. We should bring our heart rate down. We should do some soft tissue rolling, right? There'd be perfect time for that. But a lot of us have to get back to work or get to our kids. But if you're in constant motion afterwards, it's probably less of a problem. Your cool down becomes part of your normal day. So what we want people to see is that it's not like we shouldn't train, but you can't. Can you out-train a bad diet? Yes or no?
No.
So why should it be different that you can out-train a bad environmental load diet?
Right. Yeah. Makes perfect sense to me, you know.
And, you know, go ahead and squat down. I mean, just, if you, you know, move your laptop to the chair and just sit in a squat for 10 minutes. Tell me what's happening. You know, like you can create more movement options. And that's, as we have gotten a little bit more obsessed with performance, you know, in the place, you know, 10 years ago, 11 years ago, 12 years ago, 15 years ago, you read Pavel's early books, you know, and the 100 kettlebell snatch test, that used to kill people. That would literally murder people. And now you're like, yeah, it's like 4 minutes or 5 minutes of work. You know, it's a finisher. It's like a cookie. No big deal. You know, and like 15 years ago, Pavel, you know, whirled on the scene and literally ended people's lives with that thing.
Right, right.
So we're all training a little bit harder.
Sure.
We're all training a little bit smarter. I mean, my mom knows who Louis Simmons is, you know? So something has changed. She brags about her deadlift PRs all the time. And I'm like, okay, the world has changed.
What about the importance of just walking?
I think, you know, if you ask my wife, Juliet, what her number one advice, piece of advice is, she's like, you're not walking enough, you know? And we try to do as much walking as we can. We walk our kids to school 5 days a week, 4 or 5 days a week, unless we have an early meeting in the city. And we're still back at our house at like 8:15. So we have about a mile walk each way, right? It preps our kids. It's great quality time. And then if you're lucky enough and comma unlucky enough to live in a city, you're probably walking, which is really great. And this is why, you know, in some of the populations in Europe where they have bikes and walking, we're just seeing it. People are programming in what James Levine of the Mayo Clinic calls non-exercise activity, right? Non-exercise activity is not his idea, but non-exercise activity thermogenesis.
Yeah.
Is that you basically are creating a furnace. And this is a study he did, or someone did, where basically overfed people 500 calories. And those people who were constantly in motion did a lot of non-exercise activity, right? Which is not exercise. It's not training. It's just movement, right? Being a human. And they were able, they didn't gain weight when you overfed them 500 calories a day. But the sedentary people who literally got out of their car, went, sat at their desk, got back in their car, went to Netflix, those people gain massive amounts of weight because they were overfed 500 calories a day, which is my theory about why I eat ice cream and I don't get fat. Fatter.
All right. So I know we're winding down here. I have a couple of questions about the book, if you don't mind. So how did this whole project start for you?
You know what? It started because we're starting to lecture on it because we were seeing it implicate the mechanics of our high level athletes. That's how we originally got started. We did Deskbound came about because I was looking for a title for a Google talk I did back in 2010.
Yes.
Around this subject. And, you know, it seemed really that was, you know, and I think when you were in physical therapy school, I spent so much time slouched over on a stool, writing on a bed, you know, on a physical therapy table. That was our desk. And it was it was crazy. And I started to go insane and I would stand in the back. I'd be on the plinth, you know, and I tried to adopt any position that wasn't sitting because I literally felt terrible and I was trying to exercise. So that's how we got engaged. And then you know, what we realized is that people, we were seeing that really smart people, you know, who are really sophisticated, were just making these basic environmental errors or not optimizing their environment in a way that would really improve the quality of their life. And when you see this, the research studies about, you know, children, for example, that what we know on the research is that kids add about 2 percentage points BMI every year they sit in through middle school and high school. Wow. So they get a little fatter every year.
Yeah.
That's across socioeconomic and age status. But if they stand, they actually drop 2 percentage points on their body mass index, which is a delta of 4. So you can actually reverse these trends. So what we saw was that, hey, there's something going on here that we need to talk about and how it, you know, and we need to talk about it because we're seeing it and it's impacting our kids, our, you know, our family's kids, our friends' kids, and all the adults that we're seeing. But we needed to give a little more sophistication because, you know, people are like, you know, standing isn't good for you. And I'm like, well, sitting's not good for you. And if standing is at least neutral, you know, but it's not. You burn more calories. You have better engagement. I mean, there's a piece of research that was just done in a call center where they could track successful sales, right? Did you close a deal? Yes or no? 1 or 0. And they found that people who stood closed 2 deals to 1. For that company in 6 months, it only meant $40 million in sales.
Wow. Again, just standing here doing the interview, Kelly, I mean, you just feel different when you're standing up. You know, I'm like right now, I'm using my hands, I'm waving them around. It's just totally different dynamic
than when you're sitting down. When you were in trouble, did your parents make you sit down before they lectured you?
Yeah.
Yeah. Those little sneaky jerks. Like they told my mom was a psychologist. She figured that out a long time ago.
Exactly.
If you have to have a difficult conversation on the phone, do you sit down or stand up?
Ideally, you want to stand.
Yeah, you'll see that people stand up and pace back and forth, get all fired up.
Right.
It's because your brain works when you're moving. And that works for kids with ADHD or all of us. You know, these are integrated systems. So, you know, that's the heart and soul of this is just that there's so much misoptimization. As you know, when people start eating vegetables, right, and they do a little exercise and they sleep a little bit, they're like, oh my God, I feel so great. And I'm like, yeah, and remember how you used to feel before? Well, that's the problem is that, you know, we're so good at normalizing these things that we don't realize how much better we can feel.
So my point for asking, you know, how this whole project started is because this has been a project that's been in the works for years.
Yes.
This is, I mean, a lot of research, a lot of work went into this book. You know, I've been waiting for this book ever since I heard about it. Just the intrigue behind what you were going to put out there with this book and the approach. It's just phenomenal. I mean, it's just an incredible book.
Well, you know, what's great is that, you know, you'll see that Juliet is on the cover. You know, she is my partner in crime on this. And this has impacted our lives. And Juliet and I started standupkids.org 1.5 years ago. We now, through that, our partnership with Donors Choose, where we can track the number of standing desk classrooms. We have about 27,000 kids standing across America right now. And remember, when I say standing, that's moving, right? They're not sitting. And what we've seen is that this is a real public health crisis that we can solve and a communitarianism effort. You know, all we need is one teacher, which is the functional model to change. And all of a sudden, what happens when that kid's been standing? We have kids now at our elementary school have been at standing desks for 2 years. They're going to elementary school and they're terrified. And we're literally scrambling right now to get their whole middle school flip because they're like, I will not sit down. I will be standing in the back. And the middle school is freaking out too, right? So, and you know, and you know, have written a really nice book and it is a pain in the butt, you know, and I encourage anyone, if you think you have something to say, you know, go write it down in a book and find out how really, you know, how much it matters to you and to try to get it right and refine the language. And, you know, this is definitely our best effort so far. And I think it's our most important project and everyone engaged and involved with it is, you know, we're getting better at trying to deliver simpler, cleaner messages, you know, and make it more digestible. So it's very kind of you to say.
Well, there's a couple of really important books I've read recently and Kelly, you probably know, like I read a ton of books. I'm just a total book nut. And one book I read, which is by Sean Stevenson called Sleep Smarter.
Oh, yeah. That's so good.
I think it's so good. It's incredibly valuable for everyone to read this book. And I think that Deskbound is exactly like that. Just because of the culture today and everybody is sitting, and I think everybody needs the awareness around the consequences of sitting and they need solutions. And that's what this book offers. So, you know, again, the visuals that you have in Supple Leopard, Ready to Run, and now Desk Bound. So it's a very practical guide. As a matter of fact, I posted the picture on social media and someone said, I totally agree with this philosophy, but how practical is it? And I was like, well, man, I just got the book and I'm digging in here, but this book is incredibly practical. You're going to be able to take things out of it immediately and apply to your life and change behavior. And that's what it's ultimately all about. So.
Oh, we basic walking templates, you know, how to organize your desk, you know, how should you be carrying your bags? And there's a lot of takeaway in there, you know, that helps to explain even as a parent, being able to identify a good foot position or a collapsed foot position in yourself or in your child. I think, you know, if we have always operated the assumption that if we give people better information, they'll make better decisions. And then you can incorporate it in your life. It's your life. If you want to sit down, go for it. But we're going to beat you at the 5K race.
All right. So where do you want people to go to get the book? Obviously, it's going to be available on Amazon and everything. This show is going live on April 20th. And
very nice.
And I'll let you talk, but then I'm going to have a special thing that I'm going to offer to my audience.
Well, you know, you can get it Barnes & Noble. You can get it at your local bookstore. It's on Amazon for pre-sale. And we want people to know that if they go to Amazon right now, we pulled Arianna Huffington, you know, idea, and 100% of the profits from pre-sale of the book goes to Stand Up Kids and to Donors Choose. And let me just be clear. That's not any money to us. That is 100% into a staining desk project. So we're really excited about the fact that we think we can convert almost the whole school already based on just the pre-sale numbers we've seen. And so if you get a book now, you have a chance to put your money right into this kind of staining revolution.
So here's what I'm going to do. And let me ask you, how much is a standing desk? One standing desk is around $200, $250?
Yeah, that's about what a standing desk is for a kid. And you can see all that on standupkids.org. You can go to Donors Choose and see what's going on, you know?
Okay. So everybody that's listening, and I didn't even mention this to you, but for people to hear this interview, all you have to do is drop in a review for the Ardella Training Podcast in iTunes. Send me your screenshot to scott@ardellatraining.com. And then I'm going to pick 10 people. And I'm going to send you 10 copies, 10 individual copies of the winners the day that the book comes out. So the deadline to do this will be the end of the day, April the 24th. So a very small window, but 10 copies, man. I've never done that. I've given away books on the show, usually one copy, maybe three copies. And so this will cover at least one standing desk. That's my small contribution to your major cause here.
Oh, thanks, man. Well, I tell you, that is very, very, very cool. And, you know, we see this as one of those such obvious low hanging pieces of fruit that we can have massive cultural change, see a big cultural shift. And all we have to do is just a little bit at a time, you know, and good thinkers out there have been saying this for a long time. Musashi, you know, Book of the Five Rings, make your combat stance your everyday stance. The Buddha was like, don't take my word for it. See for yourself. Try this out as an intervention and see what happens. It's shocking. And it's really difficult to go backwards. You really, you know, what we find is that everyone who's made the change to a moving environment, literally when they sit down, they're like, it's terrible. I feel awful.
Right. Now, as always, and maybe you just said it, but what's the one thing specific to sitting, since that's what we've been talking about the whole time? What's something very tactical that everybody can take away out of all the guidelines and thought processes that we talked about? What can everybody take away from the interview that they've heard today?
Again, the first and foremost is to think of yourself as a moving person, and then look at when you're not moving as an adaptation error. Like you're designed to be sort of in constant motion, and that sitting is a sort of a dead end to that. And anytime you can add movement or make decisions that increase a movement richness, that you're going to benefit from that. And there's been a tipping point because, you know, you can say, hey, we all sat in the 70s and like, it wasn't great for us, but we also had more movement going on. We rode our bikes more. We walked more, you know, we weren't driven everywhere, you know, the mall didn't exist quite the same way. And so I think, you know, what does it mean to be human? What is that existential conversation? And start applying that. And I think what you'll be shocked at some of the things that you don't have to do because you're standing now.
Yeah. And, you know, again, going back to moving more, but I love the principle about if you're sitting for 30 minutes or maybe 20 minutes, like you said, make sure that you're moving, you're getting up every, you know, for 2 minutes, every 20 to 30 minutes and keep that dynamic going. As you say, we're meant to move. So keep moving. And of course, everybody knows to find you at mobilitywad.com. So Kelly, this has been awesome as expected. Thank you for coming back for a fourth time on the show, and I hope everybody gets a chance to check out this this amazing book.
Oh, man, and let me just give a shout-out to you. Check out Scott's book. Thank you so much for hosting. You guys have been so generous to us, and you know, we really think that because we have these super users who are listening to these podcasts and applying these things, that is literally the functional unit of change. So thank you guys so much.
Definitely. Thank you. And guys, be sure to take action and apply something you learned from this week's show. We'll see you next time on the Ardella Training Podcast. Take care. Hey guys, thanks for listening to the podcast this week. And if you'd like to become part of the Ardella Training community, be sure to go to ardellatraining.com/join to get your free training mistakes guide, which contains 12 critical training mistakes I made through the years. I know this 36-page guide will save you time and frustration and accelerate your training results. And it's free. You'll get that and so much more at ardellatraining.com/join. Hope to see you there.